Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, it's 8 o'clock on a Wednesday evening, 25th of July, on the Blog Talk Radio Network on the K Thompson Live Show. I'm the person that's known to be the sun, and you are. She's back. Here she is, K Thompson. You are. Here you go.
K Thompson Live, everyone. Hello, hello, hello. We have an interesting story for you tonight, an interesting show for you today, tonight, rather. We are going to be talking to Glenda Taylor. Many of you may remember Glenda. She is a philosopher. She is a cultural historian, and she has published so many books and has so many different degrees. And we have been having Glenda on for as many years as I have been on the radio or television. So in a very short period of time, we're going to welcome her. But right now, I want to talk about the latest book that she has. Well, not the latest. This is one of the books, but she talks about someone who just passed. And that someone, that entertainer who just passed, is the famous, what was the famous father of the Jackson Five, Joe Jackson. And she is going to be telling us a little bit about him, a whole lot about him, as a matter of fact. The story of Joe Jackson. He is the Jackson Five's father, and the stories and the things that he went through during his lifetime with and building the Jackson Five.
All right, we're going to be doing that at about the bottom of the hour. Right now, we're going to obviously talk about some of the earlier news today. Let's welcome one of our co-hosts, Mr. Byron Saunders. How are you doing this evening, Byron? What's going on, Byron?
Well, it's another blessed day in paradise, and as you know, that with respect to our African American history, this is a very important day in which we remember and honor the life and, unfortunately, the shortened death of Emmett Till. One of those moments where we will always remember because it ignited a movement, a reigniting of a movement, a civil rights movement that began with the Montgomery bus boycott, and then, of course, the Fannie Lou Hamer and SNCC at the Democratic National Convention, all moments that riveted around Mrs. Till's mom, Emmett Till's mother, opening that casket in Chicago and letting the world see what racism and hatred had done to her 14-year-old child. So we look back in memory and moments, but we look ahead and look forward because we are the new Underground Railroad Express right here on K. Thompson Live. This is where we bring history to life and talk about those moments in history that have been imperative, yep, and moments of moral courage and standing. So I bring that to you, but you know what? Our blessings are many. So here we are alive today, and it's nice to have you back, Kay. We missed you.
Thank you. Thank you, Byron. By the way, you're talking about Emmett Till. You know, when he had passed, his mother, yeah, insisted that his body be brought to the Apollo Theater in New York. Did you know that? Do you,
yes,
remember that?
Yes, I remember. I remember reading all of that.
And we were there.
Oh, yeah.
We were there. My ex-husband and I, we were there because we heard about it, and so forth, and that was history. So
yes, later this month,
what they did to that young man during that particular time, yes, was unbelievable and indescribable.
Yeah.
Indescribable.
That's right. But I will.
Yeah.
One of the things I can tell you that next month, August. The second week of August, I'm going down to Montgomery to see the new lynching memorial and the other museum that's there. And hopefully, with your blessings, if you guys are interested, I could set up moments for them to call in and talk to us about the museum. I think that would be very exciting for K Thompson Live. I know for me, as a historian, I'm looking forward to that sojourn, and, you know, to enlighten my own involvement in the movement and recognizing those who were lynched. So,
bless you, my friend. That would be very much welcome. I would appreciate that. Eric will appreciate that. Our audience will appreciate that, and we look forward to that on next Wednesday. What an opportunity.
Well,
are you excited about that?
Oh, yeah, because I'll be there from the 9th, going down on the 9th of August. So it'll be 2 weeks, so I can prepare. I want to make sure I call them and I let them know that we would love to have them on Kay Thompson Live. So I'll do the setup and I'll confirm all the arrangements just to make sure, you know, the hour, the time we want, you know, to make it happen. But I think it would be very important for our audience to have that connection to that historic facility.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let me go and welcome our other co-host. I believe he's on the other line, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Mr. Wayne Gilman, how are
you? Good evening. How is everyone?
All right.
How are you? I miss me too. This has been an interesting last 2 weeks. Unfortunately, I suffered a little tragedy about a week ago, right around this time, actually. And I'm just glad to be here. I had a house fire and never experienced anything like this before.
Wow.
I think I know everything I need to do now whenever something like that happens. But I'm just glad to be back.
You weren't hurt or anything, were you?
Oh, no. What happened in my house that I have in New Rochelle, I live adjacent to some college students. And every once in a while, they get to partying a little too hardy, you know. And even this time of the year, you would think nothing like this is going on because they should be in recess. But a few of them are attending college over the summer, and they call themselves having a barbecue. And the deal is that the barbecue got out of hand. I guess one of them probably used too much lighter fluid, and one side of my home is just destroyed and all that. So it's sobering to look at still, you know, and having to wait for people to come out to give you estimates, and the stench has been just incredible to deal with, but thank God I'm here. That's all I can say. And I've learned, you know, it's so funny. One thing that I must mention, that, you know, it amazes me. I always thought this thing about not snitching was a black community phenomenon. I mean, I've seen it on television shows. It's always a reference to the, you know, people who live in areas that are impoverished and all that business. And it's not really so much a nationality, but it seems that we reside in some of these areas wherever it's promoted. And you see it on TV, you hear it, you know, when you go to different events and some tragedy has occurred. But I tell you, you know, it has transcended just about every nationality, every socioeconomic situation. Doesn't matter who you are, if you don't want to snitch, you know, people have a way of just silencing themselves. And I'm amazed, you know. It's just one of those things.
You know,
but as I say, it's been an education.
If I could just jump in, you know, that's just a different way they're phrasing it. They've been doing that for years. When they've been snatching black people off the streets, hanging black people, killing slaves, they have had that policy for years. And it probably has been firmly in. And what we have found out is that it has been firmly entrenched in many police departments across the United States of America.
Oh.
So it's just called something new. That's all.
Yeah,
they've been doing that
for it. Right.
So, you know, I hope that you're able to sue all of the people involved, the college, the kids,
please.
Whoever.
Yeah.
And sue them up the wazoo so they don't have no more money to go to school, and maybe they'll get a regular job and get a job like a fireman or something like that. Then they can really realize how valuable it is, you know, because sometimes
it's amazing.
You know, they get out of hand
so
with their stuff.
Right. I don't mean to cut you off, but I agree with you wholeheartedly, man. I mean, not to get into my neighbor's business, but you know, this is one of well over two dozen homes these people have purchased, and you know, it's adjacent to a college that is soon going to be seeking university status. I think it's a collection of 10 to 12 schools. I could be wrong. Maybe you and Byron or your mom would even know this. I think 10 to 12 different colleges within a college makes it university status. I remember Montclair State used to be just Montclair College at one time, and I don't know. But I think right now the place I'm next to, Iona, is about to get that. So the town is, like, growing. And it used to be very quiet residential, almost like a retirement community. And now you would think you're in the middle of Harlem at 116th Street and Broadway by Columbia, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just crazy. But it is what it is. And I'm just glad to be here, you know? It could have been worse. It could have been worse. So
yeah.
That's
well, we're glad and blessed you're okay.
Thank you.
Let's jump into some stuff here because I got some descriptions, and we got Glenda Taylor that's going to be calling in. If she's not on hold now, she'll be calling in. And but I wanted to talk about the newest thing in the news. You know, we got the Cohen tapes, and everybody talks about it. And I was trying to think about what different slants we could take sometimes. So I'm a question that dawned in my mind is, when did Michael Cohen decide that he needed to start taping himself with Donald Trump? Because clearly this tape that they've been playing on the news now that they're playing was not done through a conversation, and Cohen wasn't at home where, you know, he taped the conversation from his house. He had to have a tape recorder on him, turn it on before he goes into this meeting with Donald Trump. So I'm wondering, you know, I guess my question is, what was his reasoning? What was he thinking? Did he think that eventually Trump was gonna screw him? Did he think that what we're doing is so nefarious that I better record this in case, you know, he tries to double cross me and I need to double cross him? I'm trying to figure out why you made the tape in the first place, because surely it's not like he's at his office where people say some lawyers, you know, tape this client's phone call, you know, and they turn on the tape recorder at the office for note taking and for accuracy's sake. But this is outside, like he's undercover. So I'm wondering, what was the reason? What do y'all think? I don't know. I have my own opinions.
Yeah.
Well, I'll weigh in on that at this point. My whole thing about the tapes and who released it, why they released it, I really don't care about the tapes because it's trying to make me focus and the public focus on something that is very sullen and a reputation that's already been established as someone who's an thug and who's the crime committed, not the tape. The crime that I'm interested in and why there's no conversation about it is adultery, treason, and obstruction of justice. These are real crimes. Okay, and so if you want to wrap me up into a tape of he said, she said, why said, I don't care what was said. I am more interested in why a Christian, so-called Christian right of evangelicals this is a person who has broken the Ten Commandments, every commandment. Think about it. He's broken all Ten Commandments and the seven deadly sins. So that's 17 faults in this, and you want me to get wrapped up in a tape? No, sir. I'm not buying into that. Let me talk about adultery. Let's talk about the fact that he's stealing. Let's talk about he's killing, because he is accomplice to murder. The Charlotte event, the events where his name has engaged people to be violent. Come on now. Let's have that conversation. Everything else, you want me to talk about a tape? Yeah, okay. So what? He got caught. They're both guilty. They're both from the Crimes R Us, from Thugs R Us. That's what they are. They're a crime family.
I tell you, not to butt in there, Byron, but the one thing that really gets to me is how the Republican Party makes a big deal about having to record conversations if you're an attorney, like as if there's something unethical about that. I mean, if you're broadcasting it and you're doing it intentionally just to, you know, entrap someone, that's one thing. But these were tapes that were basically came to light because of Mueller's investigation. But if you listen to Trump and his associate, his current representative, Juliana, as the Reverend Jesse Jackson would refer to him, you know, you would think that they committed some crime, or Cohen committed a crime to do that. And I guess Cohen now has just come to his senses. I was a week ago listening or watching MSNBC, and our good friend, the Reverend Al Sharpton, apparently had a get-together with him one morning for breakfast. It's the only time you can get to see Al these days. He's giving up lunch and dinner. Ha, ha, ha. You know, but that's just a personal joke. Anyhow, but the deal is that, you know, it was almost like a Jesus come to home meeting for Cohen to sit down and basically discuss how he's seeking a new identity. He knows he's in deep trouble now. And
right.
And I guess he realizes his back is up against the wall. So does Trump, but, you know, he's going to carry on with his bravado and act like as if he's changed the world. And one thing he does say all the time that I am beginning to believe more and more, that there's been no other president like him. Every day, you know, I'm reminded of that statement that he makes, that, you know, he's an unusual phenomenon, like we've never experienced anyone like that. And it's true. I mean, we've seen people who suffer from the disease of megalomania and all sorts of arrogance and bravado, but, you know, not on the level of Donald Trump. And right. I know you guys must have discussed Helsinki last week. You know, it was an embarrassment, you know. I have greater respect for Putin now than I do for Trump.
Yeah, yeah, well, Trump. Let's see if this is our guest, Glenda Taylor, on the other line, and see if she wants to comment on this issue before we get off into her book. Hi, Glenda, is this you, 6-3? Hello? Glenda? Taylor? Caller? 631-801? All right, then. Well, anyway, I kind of lost my train of thought, but the what I've learned is that there are no more rules in America. I mean, everything we thought about is kind of, you know, the facade of America is coming down, right? This whole kind of you know, orderly society, democracy. Here's a guy that's flipping all that on its ear, and he is doing that with the Republican Party, a party that's supposed to know better and have the best interests of the country as a whole in mind, and they're being totally complicit in his in what he's doing to this country. And I mean, to the point where this man has committed things that I consider treason, and many other people do, to the point where he's trying to do classic criminal work, silence his critics with the whole stripping of security clearance of people from the previous administration. You're trying to quiet the people who know that you're committing a crime. That's the whole funny thing. That's why he went in the room with Putin, because everybody's wondering what they said. It was nothing said. He was going in the room with Putin to get the negatives. You know? That's what that is. That's classic, you know, classic Frank Underwood stuff. Come on, man. He's like, okay, when I become the president, we'll have a meeting, and then you'll give me the negatives, and no one will be there and all that. Come on. Come on. I'm seeing that. You know, I mean, it's so obvious. And these people that are so – the scary thing is that I was talking about to my cousin, discussing this with my cousin a little while ago, that scary thing is not that these people are so ignorant, because they truly are his hardcore followers. There's an ignorance there. But there's also a willingness to be ignorant, right? There's also an intentional ignorance, because as you become more intelligent and evolve, no clear thinking person in this day nowadays can truly think that they're superior over any race. Any race is superior over any other race. There's individuals, of course, of all stripes that have superior abilities, but you can't say with any type of factual knowledge that people are superior over a total another group of people. So clearly that's been debunked, right? So wouldn't you, in your intelligence and your growth as you learn more, get to the point where, you know, that stuff doesn't make sense anymore. It doesn't make sense to be racist anymore, right?
I think we may have Glenda Taylor on that.
Well, let's see if Glenda is available again. Hold on a sec. Hey, caller, how you doing? 631, Glenda Taylor, is that you calling in? Hello.
Yes, I'm here.
All right. There you go. All right. All right, Glenda. How you doing? We just wanted to know before we get off into the book, if you wanted to talk a little bit. I know that you've had some very interesting observations. If you wanted to talk about anything about what you noticed that this president is doing, I know that I thought I overheard you and my mom talking that you really didn't want to talk about anything Trump, but I certainly know that you have some opinions about it. So what are your opinions?
I think America is in a very embarrassing situation, and I think that the Congress and the Senate have the power to do something about it. And that's all I can say. They have the power to do something about it.
Period.
And
it's out.
It doesn't appear that, you know, they're willing to do anything.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like we spend too much time on Trump, you know, all the time. And, you know, you really get tired of it because he really makes you angry. So, and I am angry right now about him. And I hope that, you know, anyway. Glenda, yes, Eric.
We got another 9 minutes. Let's talk a little bit more politics. We said 8:30.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about. Okay. Well, the boss of the show said no. That's the editorial comment. And cut that. There you go. Knocked out.
All right. Got that. Gentlemen, don't you agree with me?
Absolutely.
Aren't you tired of talking about Trump? We're making him more important than he is. For God's sake, you know. But listen, Glenda is a known author. And, you know, I've talked about Glenda many, many, many times before. She has so many degrees, I can't even count them anymore. And she has a master's degree. She has, Glenda, can you just tell us what kind of degrees you have? Just give us a little rundown, by the way.
Only a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD.
No, that's it. Your doctor, Glenda Taylor, how many times?
Just one time. I did my PhD in last year, 2017.
Wow.
And that was the latest degree, but how many other degrees do you have? How many other degrees do you have?
It's not that many. It's only the associate's, bachelor's, master's, and a PhD. That's all.
Yeah, sure, that's all. Master's of Arts degree in History and Culture from Union Institute and University. She also studied abroad at the University of Ghana, Institute of African Studies in Accra, Ghana, and the University of Science and Technology in Kumasi, Ghana. She has been featured in the New York Times for her exhibits on African American history. And in 2010, the New York Daily News selected her as one of America's great people. Now, that's just a small chart or a small part of what you've done, writing about different people, including the importance and greatness of African American women and African women, period. So am I on the right track?
Yes, you are.
All right, so now we're going to be talking about a man, though. We're going to be talking about a man with a famous family, Joe Jackson. He just died not too long ago, this week, I think.
Yeah,
so tell us.
I think it was June 25th or June 27th.
Oh, okay.
27th, yes.
And why are you writing about him? What have you found out?
What happened is I did my dissertation on Michael Jackson, and I did it on the artistry of Michael Jackson, and I specifically was showing how Michael Jackson was using his art, that he was consciously using his art to promote societal change and social justice. But in order to understand Michael Jackson, you have to understand his father, Joseph Jackson. And there's a public narrative that only talks about Joe and how tough he was and abusive and his kids wanted to get away from him. But it really doesn't get to the heart of the man and his consciousness or have any understanding that he was someone who was born in 1928 or 29, and he grew up in a certain time, and he wanted children to be successful, and he did not want them to have the type of he did not want them to be involved in gangs and drugs and what was going on in his neighborhood.
So he disciplined
them the way people of that period disciplined their children. And basically, he was very interesting. His story is very interesting because his father, who was born in 1893, had a master's degree. And he was a professor and a headmaster of a school. So Joseph Jackson did not have a degree, but he was raised by a father who, in that period, in the early 20th century, had a master's degree. So he knew how to teach and to train his children.
So
is there any information as to why, not to cut you off, Glenda, why he did not pursue further education, considering his father sort of laid a blueprint for him to follow, or?
I really don't know. That's a really good question. But Joe Jackson, he was married. He started pursuing boxing. He got involved in boxing, and which he was very successful at. He decided not to do that. He got married. He divorced his first wife. It was a very short marriage. I think it was less than a year. And then he met his wife, Catherine Spruce, and he married, and they got married in November of 1949, and his daughter was born about 7 months later, Rebe, which is 1950, and then Jackie, 1951, and then Tina. You know, so I think what happened is his family was growing, and he was very committed to supporting his family, and he would do any type of job to work and support his family, including, picking potatoes. So he was a very hard-working, committed person who basically has been demonized since the 90s because, what in those days was not considered abuse is considered abuse today. And I'm not saying that he was not hard and harsh, but he was someone who wanted to take his children, all of them. And there is no one that we can name who has taken 9 children and create that kind of mega. I mean, he did it with all of his children. He did it with the Jackson 5. He did it with Janet. He did it with Rebe, Randy, all of them. All of those children, reached the pinnacle of success. I mean, and he produced Michael Jackson, who's, commercially and, as far as his art, one of the most successful artists or entertainers who ever lived. He produced Janet, who is extremely successful, and all of his children have, hit the Billboard charts and had successful records. And he invested money in all of them, and he did whatever it took, including his daughter, his youngest, children.
Amazing. Yeah.
He's really an amazing person.
He really was amazing.
Well, the thing that's amazing about him is he was born in 1928. So when he had his first child, I guess he was 22, because she was born in 1950. So this is someone who in 1950, this is pre Emmett Till. And so you know what that was and the period that he was growing up. And he was determined that he didn't care that his kids were, these little Negroes. He knew they were talented, and he felt that his family, and he felt that it's a parent's responsibility to nurture and develop the children's talents. So his wife, Catherine, was the one that started recognizing the children were talented because he had his little part-time group, and he was involved. And the young guys, they were watching him. And that's, the story that you've heard about Tito. All of a sudden he realized that Tito could play a guitar. And then he took the oldest three, and he was training them when he realized how talented they were. And then they realized his wife realized that Michael, in his diapers, when he was like less than 2 years old, was dancing to, you know, their broken washing machine, the rickety washing machine, and he was sitting there dancing. And before you knew it, Michael was a part of the group, and they realized, and then Michael just kind of took the lead, and they just followed the lead, and he became the lead singer. And he was totally committed to them. That's why when they, Berry Gordy didn't want a group of young people. He didn't want Stevie Wonder. So as far as he's concerned, another five young people he didn't want. But it was the skill and talent combined with the training that they got from their father that forced Berry Gordy to say, I have to do this. And, you know the rest of the story.
Well, he certainly, I mean, they certainly set a trailblazing activity for others to come behind them because at just in that same period, maybe a little later on in the 1950s, there was a very popular game show on TV called You Bet Your Life by Groucho Marx. And
yeah.
I occasionally, when I'm bored, I'll go into a lot of old YouTube. And I remember seeing... There's another family like the Jacksons, and I guess they followed the Jacksons after the Silvers. I don't know if you remember them. They had a whole bunch of kids. And they were the mother and father were contestants on one of the Groucho Marx shows, and they showed how their young family was basically mirroring what you just described about the Jacksons earlier on, and and we're talking the 50s, so 55, I think we had Emmett Till. Certainly Jim Crow was in full swing since the 30s. So, I mean, it was a very interesting period to be in.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, because when you think about it, he understood Jim Crow. He experienced, you know, the segregation, but he was determined that he was not, he wanted his children to perform before all audiences, and he did that long before, you know, the Jim Crow law ended. You know, Jim Crow law. He was taking them and training them. He started teaching them, and the back story. But, you know, the only thing that we hear about in the public narrative about him is how he was abusive and how he was doing that. And another thing, too, is his children, Michael, LaToya, a few of them, you know, said that he was harsh and he beat them and they were afraid of him. But long, you know, it's over 25 years that all of them have forgiven him. They've put it in their books. You know, they tell you, Michael said he was a genius. Michael gave this whole speech in 2001 at Oxford University in which he said he forgave his father. And it wasn't until he became a parent that he understood his father better. And he realized based on the period that his father came up in, and Janet says that in her book also, that he felt, you know, that he was following the example of his parents because his father was a strict disciplinarian. And he said he realized his father had ways of showing love that he didn't understand at the time. And Janet said in her book that she realized that that was the way he knew love, is to try to make you have a successful life. So all of them who said certain things about how he beat them and he did this and he did that, all of them now, I guess they're older, they're over 50 years old, most of them are over 60 at this point, and they realized that they would not have the wealth or the success for the legacy if it were not for, you know, Joseph Jackson.
They were
so
not in existence.
The reason why I did the book on him is because I got that information is really a part of the dissertation. And I think that it's time in our country that we start focusing and finding out the secrets of someone who achieved what he did when he achieved it. Because if he could do that when he did what he did, and if a Berry Gordy could do that when he did it in the 50s and the 60s, then what's possible for us today? And we're so busy focusing on people's negative qualities that we're not focusing on what we can learn from them. And there's a lot to learn from Joseph Jackson. There's a lot to learn. Like, for example, I always say this about Whitney Houston. I mean, everybody knows that this was a great voice, but how many of us know her creative process? and what she did to excel and to do what she did. Because with all of her personal challenges, Whitney never failed. She was always at the top of the charts. Her films were all successful. She set the standard that it's going to be a while before anybody could even try to break her records. And you know what I'm saying? The films, the books, not the books, the records, and the same thing with Michael. He set standards. And these people did it when they were faced with obstacles that we do not have today. And I think we need to focus on how they made it, because that teaches the next generation what they could do.
I agree with you, Glenda, because breaking the stereotype that has been for decades and centuries, so almost 400 years, of profiling African Americans or the African diaspora as being black, negative, you know, condescending, lazy, shiftless, and yet we still have high achievers from a family who pretty much rose itself up from their bootstraps and created a musical industry all around
five
talented people. That's incredible. That's worthy of raising funds.
Michael has sold 50 million records since he died.
Wow!
You know what's it's also a testament to Joe was he was a hard dude, right? I mean, for all everybody's impression of Joe Jackson was that he was a hard man, and during his era, he was a black man of his era, right? Plus a musician,
that's right?
And so people talk about, like you said, people talk about him being hard on his kids and abusive. Somebody said something to me, I forget who it was, a friend of mine said, but he made all his sons millionaires, multimillionaires,
right?
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's that old ethic, that old school ethic of just working hard, busting your butt to get it done. And you know, the whole thing about him having a reputation as a taskmaster, I mean, even in these movies, these docudrama movies that you see, of him drilling them into rehearsals, those old steps, those old routines that those old R&B groups used to do with such precision. And he was a taskmaster to make sure his boys, once he really realized how much talent potential they had is when he really, you know, made sure. So, you know, it's like you said, people could say a lot of things about him, but a lot of the time I've heard from several different sources that Joe was always the pro-black, you know, if he could do business with a black businessman. And I heard some stories of people talking about, you know, he was always trying to do businesses or certain business with certain African Americans, or would give preference to if a black person had a business. I met him once, my mother, when Mom, you were on WLIB radio when they did the Victory Tour.
Yeah.
And we went to the press conference at Tavern on the Green.
Mm-hmm.
This is when Don King was the concert promoter.
Exactly.
And we finagled our way, my mom and my sister Gina, who now lives in Bermuda, we finagled our way to the little more VIP area, and I got a chance to just say hello to Joe Jackson, Mr. Jackson, and you know, let him know who I was, and I was there with my mom on the radio, and, you know, he kind of, I think maybe I even had a card or something for some reason, I forget what it was, but he took my card or whatever, he looked me in the eye and said, okay, brother, you know, and I could tell he was like, you know, when you meet other black people, other black men, or people that are progressive in terms of doing business together or try to have a progressive attitude. That was the feeling I got from him, from that brief exchange,
mm-hmm.
that he was like, okay, I hear you, brother, you know. So,
that's nice.
I mean, that was my one experience. Excuse me for chilling, but wanted to share that.
Yeah. You know, as you mentioned that, Eric, I'm reminded of something that's almost similar to that, and there was a certain amount of pride when you could do it all by yourself and do it within the confines of the community. I remember some discussion that when James Brown met Don Cornelius, and Don was successful to have his own television show for almost, I think, 30 years before it went off the air, and it was all based on his talent to have that Soul Train image to challenge what was the order of the day back then, Dick Clark, even if there was misinformation, not to say that Dick Clark was a racist, he clearly wasn't, but maybe he did not know the depths of what was going on within our culture other than what he was exposed to. But I'll never forget, there was an interview between the late, great Frankie Crocker and James Brown, and how astounded James Brown was that Don Cornelius was able to have a show like that, and it was all, back then, black money. You didn't have to count on anyone white for the proceeds or and things like that. And,
right.
you know, it was just a sense of pride that,
Yeah, you're
had.
Referencing in the documentary about James Brown, Don King recounts that story about James Brown asking him when he did the show, like, "Hey, brother, you know, this is a really nice setup. Who you got working with you here?"
Okay,
you know,
gotcha.
And Don King recounts the story, telling James Brown's like, "No, brother, it's me," you know. And he said he asked him like three different times, talking about the show during the course of the day. Like, "Yeah, brother, this is a
right,
nice
right,
operation.
Right.
Who you got doing
yeah.
this with you?" He said, "Brother, it's just me, you know." And he said he realized
yeah.
that James thought that there was the, you know, he was down. He had a partnership with a white man or with a white organization.
And that's usually the case.
And
I mean,
certainly at that time, you know.
Right, right. And I mean, to a certain extent, I'm not saying that you don't need that kind of support now, but. You know, it when you look at the Joe Jackson history and when you talk about the beatings, I got into a philosophical discussion with an old friend of mine about the origin of black children being beaten. And technically, you know, I think of slavery in this country. But, you know, when you look at the culture of the British Empire and what they did in the Caribbean and other parts of the world where they had an influence, that whole thing of beating has had a pivotal impact on how you and I interact with each other, because and again, this, you know, this is just speculation and conjecture, but you don't see and the Spanish Empire was just as great back then, but you don't see that so much in cultures that they dominated. You see men kissing their sons as well as they would kiss their wives and daughters and things like that. With us, you just don't see that closeness. It's almost, this is part of the slave mentality that we embraced. I mean, I could be wrong, but this is something to be theorized.
Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree with you. I'm going to have to beg to disagree. That hasn't been my experience. Although I will agree that it is something that needs to be more openly expressed. I think also, too, the beating aspect, we talk about corporal punishment or disciplining kids with physical, that was, and you mentioned slavery, I think that was at a time, too, also when parents wanted their kids to obey them because they knew the slave master, and the other ramifications were so much worse, you know, but I do agree with you that the lineage of corporal punishment or using physical whatever, obviously that came from the Europeans, right?
Yeah. Right, I mean, and again, maybe everybody's different. Everybody's experience is different. But I can tell I've never seen, you know, that kind of interaction. I knew I loved my dad, but the thought of embracing him—it wasn't until I was an adult that I could actually say that I experienced. And I know so many other guys of Caribbean background the same way. But can you get a beating for one of them? Yes, Mon. We're gonna get the belt out tonight, and you'll never do this again, Mon. You know, wait till your mother come home.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. I know we're off topic.
Let me talk to Glenda. Glenda, see what you have had, what you opened up?
Yeah, I'm enjoying this.
I know. But listen, let's even out the story here. Now, you also have in your book, you know what I'm talking about, the Jalamuso's drum. I've talked about it before. Female entertainers. Now, talk about Marion Anderson, Lena Horne, Ruth Brown, Nina Simone, Etta James, Aretha Franklin, and Eartha Kitt. They have not only been entertainers, you know, but they did, you know, play important, you know, parts with the civil and the human rights movement. Also, Nikki Giovanni, Jean Noble, Alice Walker, Paul Giddings, and a whole lot more of and the Jalamuso's drum, you know, you call them Jalamuso. Now, you have the description what you mean by calling them a Jalamuso, so please share that with everybody.
Well, Jalamuso is a griot or cultural historian, and what I was basically saying in that book was that they were using their autobiographies to tell our story which is often ignored. And you have a lot of different perspectives of what was happening during that period when you read Etta James, Mary Nennison, and all the people that, you know, spoke of. Because people like Lena Horne and Josephine Baker, Catherine Dunham, they were best Joe Jackson's period. They could have been his oldest siblings. Because he had five of them. He had four siblings. But his aunts and uncles, he had 20, according to his wife's own, you know, autobiography. But it was very interesting when you read their book. Because they're telling the story. Nina Simone, all of them. They have very interesting stories. And they're talking about a period of American history from the early 20th century to the 60s.
Yeah.
Even now,
you know, we have a whole lot of entertainers. But you know, I also want to mention one entertainer who's still on the air and going strong, and that's Whoopi Goldberg. We shouldn't cut her out or leave her out of anything, okay? Because I think she is in danger of McCain's daughter, because McCain's daughter considers herself as the next Whoopi Goldberg.
I don't know about that, but I think that the
I'm asking Glenda to comment on this, Eric.
Okay.
This is a female thing.
Okay.
Glenda.
Well, I love Whoopi Goldberg. I think she's a great actress, and no one could replace her. McCain's daughter. Whoopi is Whoopi, and when you watch her, I don't get a chance to watch the show, but when you watch her, you can just see how intelligent she is, and her amazing. So, she cannot be replaced. She's another one who beat the odds.
One of the greatest actresses.
I remember after The Color Purple when they said, what are they going to do with Whoopi Goldberg? Because she was so good at what she did. So, it's, you know, and I don't know if you got a chance to see that play, Summer, on Broadway, about Donna Summer. And when you see that, it's really great. It's wonderful. And it makes you think about the people that you mentioned, Ruth Brown, Etta James, all of them. Whitney Houston, all of them. They could do a similar play because the music is just amazing. Even Dionne Warwick. When Dionne Warwick's performances, I don't know her personal life, but when you listen to her songs, she just every song she put out during, you know, the 60s and that period were hits. And they put out so many more songs, you know, than they do today. But Donna Summer, it was just amazing. I said, wow. I knew the songs, but you just didn't realize how huge she really was.
Yeah. Also, you know, just to mention a few other female entertainers that you have touched the names on. Catherine Dunham, who is also a great dancer. Nina Simone, Mississippi, goddamn. Lena Horne, Diane Carroll, Etta James, and other African-American female entertainers. They had quite an impact on society, say you. And it's true, right?
Yes, I totally agree. Yeah, they were blacklisted too because of it. Usher Kidd was blacklisted because of her Lady Bird Johnson, and you know, they have definitely made a great contribution. And I think that we have a responsibility to look into their stories and rewrite the narrative, because
absolutely.
You know, you could ignore them, or you could demonize them, or you could talk about, you know, their drug issues. And that doesn't accomplish anything but paint us in a bad light, but it's not exploring, like, how did they do? How did they get to the point that they did? Because even in the 80s, Michael Jackson was experiencing Jim Crow. They didn't want to put him on MTV. You know,
right.
And that's the 1980s. You know, that was supposed to have ended in 65. But, you know, 20 years later, they said, you know, nobody was going to want to listen to Thriller. Right? And what happened?
Right. Can you imagine?
Yeah, so he was born in 1958. He was born 3 years after 1958. So I'm just saying, what can a young person who studies Michael and the real history, or the, you know, the females that you named, what, you know, what can they learn, and how much greater could they be if they were studying, you know, about his artistry and his creative process, or the creative process of Whitney Houston, or people like that, or Dionne Warwick? I mean,
New Jersey ladies, New Jersey women.
Well, we're studying that instead of talking about, you know, her failed marriage and this and that, and you know that documentary that came out. I don't know if you saw it yet, but I mean the most beautiful thing is her voice. She still makes me want to stand up and salute the American flag.
Oh yeah.
You know, but we're not studying their greatness. We're studying their Achilles heel, their force.
Yeah.
As you mentioned this, Glenda, I should refer to you as Dr. Taylor because, I mean, you have more education than our current president when I stop and think about it. But the bottom line is, what is it about our people, our culture, that we just don't seem to – I've heard in discussions I've had with people in the business – that we're a culture of the minute. You know, it's like the kind of reverence that, for instance, a Frank Sinatra would have received if he was still living. You know, different generations of people would go to Radio City Music Hall or Madison Square Garden, any of these huge emporiums to see somebody, even if he couldn't sing how he used to sing 30, 40 years before, they would just come out there, you know, just to see him breathe on stage. You know, when it comes to us, you know, if you want to fill those places, you got to have a current act. Why is it that we don't seem to embrace people from the past the way?
Well, one thing you have to remember, that's why all the entertainers want to go to the Apollo, remember they used to say? Because we're hard on people. You know, we're very hard. And we look at our acts with a critical eye and we're very creative, and we're trying to, you know, explore into the new. But I think we also let other people write the narrative, and we have to stop. Dick Gregory said in the early 60s that the Negro must take control of his image. And we have never done that. And that includes what's in writing and what's in documentary. And we allow our heroes and our heroes to be defined by other people, and we have, as a society, since the 80s, we all are Americans as a whole, have gotten into this tabloid conversation. That we have a tabloid president, you know. I don't know if you read the last article.
You know, let me just jump in. Let me just jump here for a minute. Let me, if I can. Because I kind of have to reject, I have a reflex of rejecting when we say, we make sweeping generalizations. Why can't we just have this conversation about somebody in a neighborhood that was having issues? And it's, this woman used the same generalization, like, why don't we? And I do that sometimes jokingly, but I know that that's not the case. But, you know, there's an extra burden on people of color, right? Particularly black people, because we're usually the darkest ones on the people of color spectrum, right? So there's an extra burden on us to overcome the oppression that's been faced over these 400 years. So if in the course of that, overcoming that, our humanity that happens to other humans comes where we get beat down, a lot of us, or some of us get distracted by the events of the moment, which is just human nature, then that's an extra burden that we have. But when we make broad, sweeping generalizations saying, why can't we? Because then I look at the exceptions to the rule. So it's not all of us. And it's I think our burden is so much greater because of the things we've had to overcome, and also because we're human like everybody else. So, yeah, we want to go to the movies, and, you know, I mean, for example, and you know, some of those images that I thought included me too, you know, and worshiping some of these idols and these movie stars and Elvis and all those people that you would see the movies and them being all cool, then come to find out, you know, their sphere of existence doesn't include you. You know, or what they think about America, it doesn't include you. So, you know, that's why we used to get so excited when black people were on TV, if you remember back in the day. You know, like some black people on TV, you call everybody in the house down to the TV, you see that one black person on TV that night, right? So, you know, there are exceptions to the rule. I think that extra burden of this oppression that we've had, you know. Kanye West made that comment about a couple of months ago, you know, about slavery being a choice, sound like a choice, and caught a whole lot of flack for it.
Yeah.
And I guess in a certain way, if you're looking at it, yeah, why did the multitude of slaves who probably outnumbered the slave masters revolt at that time. And come to find out, yeah, it happened often. It happened a lot. You know, so I think that when we address these things, not to be, you know, just broad sweeping like that. I know it's probably the majority of people that you can include when you say that, but I just don't want us to say it like, why include everybody, you know? I mean, I agree with you, Wayne. It's probably 80% of our people that have a certain mentality that is detrimental to, you know, their forward progress, and we fall prey to a lot of this stuff, you know? I mean, look at the shows that are on now,
right? I mean, a lot of it is by design. I mean, black people dictate American culture. I don't care what anyone says. You know, you hear certain expressions. You know, when I see white folks out there embracing each other, say, yo, bro, this, that, the other, you know, I know where that came from. When I see them dance and interact, you know, I mean, the deal is we are who we are. But you're right. Sometimes we're really hard on ourselves, and I often wonder why, you know. That whole thing
about
our
own worst enemy
that,
too. I agree with you.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the deal. So, you know, Blender has.
Lena Horne said, and I'm sure you've all heard it, that, and it's in her daughter's book when she wrote about the Horne family. She said that black people knew. She's talking about her period. You know, the period from the Jim Crow era, that they didn't have. They could never be. Less than or equal to. They had to be better than.
Exactly.
Not just their own. They had to be better than white. They had to be twice as good. And I think that sometimes we criticize each other or look at the flaws when we're not, you know, like, say, for example, and I'm not talking about any particular president, but if our last president did less than 1% of what this president did, not only would we be criticizing him, but he probably would not be president right now. So, you know, like you said, there's a different standard for us.
Right.
We're responsible for writing the narrative.
But, you know,
yeah,
we also, like, you know, on your point, Wayne, it's, you know, we produce some things, you know, that are detrimental to make it big, you know, but certain images, like the whole hip-hop game, right? I mean, that whole...
Mm-hmm.
The history of that and the certain images when they started going to gangster rap and referring to women as the B word and cats calling each other and the whole thing, you know, it's not, like I always say, in entertainment, it's not the particular form of entertainment, that particular piece, but it's balance, right? So the big record companies allow, that are controlled by the, you know, mostly people that don't look like us, they allow these type of records to get out. You know, let's put out the gangster rap. And let's hold back on the positive rap, because you remember early in the early 90s, it was more positive, right? Certainly on the East Coast.
Right.
So when the other thing comes out and it starts making fast money and all that, you know, and Biggie Smalls, and I love all that too, but it becomes unbalanced, just like our images, the images that were reported of us in the media. You remember for years, I mean, you being a news person, know of all people, that usually the images of black people were usually negative images of black, of us,
and it's,
you know,
still
that
today.
Reported.
I mean, I
yeah,
try
absolutely.
To separate the two, but you turn the TV on today, open the paper, it's the same thing. You wonder, why is this the image? You know, what are they a subliminal way of trying to sell something to you, and it's just unfortunate. But you know, this is part of the campaign of making America great again. Certain things we'll just never get away from.
Well,
that's right.
Know.
You get the last word. Wayne gets the last word, Glenda. We got a minute. Okay. Well, let's start to sign off because we've got a minute left in the show. And I want to say 60 seconds. The lady just said, a little automated voice. I want to say thank you to Glenda Taylor for calling in and giving us your opinion. I knew we were going to get you to talk about politics, Glenda, even though I heard you didn't want to. And thanks for talking about your book. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Glenda.
Thank you for having me.
All right. All right, take care. I want to say thank you to Brother Byron Saunders, fantastic co-host, historian.
Oh, absolutely, and I want to personally thank Glenda for the books she sent to me, Blind Light, and Want to Be Starting Something, which she personally autographed. Glenda, you are the best.
All right.
The greatest.
Thank you.
Self. Peace and love. Everybody.
All right. Thank you, Byron. Thank you, Brother Wayne. All right, Brother Wayne.
Thank you,
brother. All right. Take care.
Thank you.
I'm Citizen Payne. You are?
Kay Thompson.
On the Kay Thompson Live Show every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. or archive. Sorry, we had to go. We ran out of time. We got in a little bit of a really good discussion there. Take care, everybody. Got to go.